Really nice article by Ajahn Suchito, one of my favorite teachers, called Kama and the End of Kama. And if you just Google it, you'll find a PDF file that you can download. And I think really, for me, quite some time ago, gave me a really helpful perspective on practice and what it's about. And to some extent was an inspiration for this talk. So, for many years now, I've been having a little New Year's gathering for Dharma friends. I shouldn't say little, it's quite large gathering of Dharma friends on New Year's Day. And we just have a potluck and people, you know, kind of talk. And so one year I had this event, and after everybody left, there was this black wooden block here with some writing in white. And I don't know, didn't know at the time who left it, but I figured out later. So I want to read it to you. Karma means I can rest easy at night knowing all the people I treated badly had it coming. So that doesn't quite fit with Dalai Lama's saying that my religion is one of kindness. And it turns out that karma is actually one of the two categorical teachings of the Buddha. It's really one of the two most important parts of the teaching. So the other is the four ennobling truths or duties or whatever way you want to translate Ariya Sancha. And at the time of the Buddha, there were a whole lot of, just like there are now, a whole lot of views about whether we had free will or not and whether actions made a difference, how much control we have. And the predominant view at the time was based on astrology, so that our fate was kind of determined by the stars, and it really was a notion of fate. Everything was kind of predetermined. And the Buddha, focused on empirical evidence that didn't seem to be the case. And that seems like, from our perspective, well, this is pretty obvious. You know, if you go out and drink all night, you're going to have some effects from that. Actions clearly make a difference. If you treat people meanly, it's going to influence how they respond to you. What was kind of unique about the way he looked at karma is he focused on something called intention. And intention is a very important concept in the Buddhist tradition. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. But what he's looking at is, intention or motivation. It's the psychological impact of our actions, how we form a character out of our actions, and how people respond to us. So the word karma is the etymology of it is derived from a root word kur, which means to make. So then the question is, what do you make? What is made from karma? And so there are three distinct senses of the word karma. One is the kind of, and they're inseparable. One is a decision to do something. The next one is the action itself. And the third is a result. Okay. So basically what happens is, moment to moment, we make decisions, we act. These are kind of mental formations, intentions. We act, and there's some result occurring from it. That seems pretty straightforward, pretty simple, right? So what do we make? What we make are patterns of behavior. And these patterns are what we sense ourselves to be. We think, if maybe we're really kind, compassionate person, we think, we identify, that's what we are, we're kind and compassionate. If we're always fearful, I'm a fearful person. If we're angry, you can go on and on. Or then you can kind of step into the, I'm a productive person, right? That's the message we get in this society. We should be productive. We should achieve something. We should make a difference. And we get these messages and they influence the way we behave. And we identify with these behaviors. And, we could be fearful, critical, cynical, generous, compassionate, all these different ways of being. One of my particular patterns was this defender piece I had from things that happened to me as an early child. So, I mean, it's not like we're, these patterns get formed out of conditions about the way we're, you know, we're born, the family we're in, the way we're wired, the society we're in. And, you know, for me, because of a lot of things that happened to me, I had this part that if someone really tried to push me around or take advantage of me, there would just be this really strong defensive reaction to it. And I've worked with that for a long time. It's pretty much gone now. I wouldn't say it's totally gone. It never is, but it's really mellowed out quite a bit. So some of these patterns are skillful and others aren't. And the thing is that one thing that's really nice about this teaching is that we shouldn't really, you know, it isn't skillful to judge yourself for these things. You know, people are the way they are because of what's happened to them in their life, and they formed a particular way of behaving. And I think that can be really helpful in terms of the way you look at yourself as well as the way you look at other people. You know, people who might be really annoying and you just can't believe how they are, or, you know, that they just came into this world. I mean, it's not even that bad things necessarily have to happen to them. They could be, you know, in the womb and there's something that's affecting the mother's chemistry and you come out of a particular way. And then you get parents and you're born in society and you're given all these messages about truth and the way you should behave. And that forms our sense of what we are. And so I find that really helpful in terms of, you know, forgiveness, not getting angry to people, things like that. You know, I've told this story a lot of times about my first high school girlfriend who, you know, she was a year older than me, and then she went to college, and, you know, so that was sort of the end of that. And then somehow 3 or 4 years later, we hooked up again, and I thought we were going to get married, and then she didn't show up for the holiday when she was supposed to come back, and then I found out she was marrying some other guy, and she was working in some college to get married. And, you know, there was this practice that I took on for a while where you just made a list of everybody you ever knew and see if you could find a way to love them. And so, well, okay, she's resolved her causes and conditions. It really lowers the charge to things. It's really helpful, and to yourself as well. So karma isn't something that the self has. Karma is what the sense of self is. So this teaching of not self, or the Buddhist teaching of not self, is this is a really skillful way into it, to see that what you perceive as yourself are these patterns of behavior that have been learned and conditioned. And really, one of the nice things about that is they're dynamic. We can change. And other people can change. So it's not like a fate type sort of thing. It's like, okay, we habitually behave a certain way. Maybe we always get angry, or maybe we always say yes to people, or name whatever behavior you have is fairly, or maybe you get furious at things, you know, and that would be sort of like my defense mechanism character. To see that that's not what you are, it's just these patterns, and there's this sense of this is who I am. We identify with that. So a lot of times we hear this teaching of not self, or and usually some people people use the word no self, but Ajahn Tanisaro, who's done a lot of translations, translates not self, and I think that's a lot more helpful translation. The Buddha never said whether it's a self or not a self. There are these dialogues where maybe he sort of infers not there isn't a self, but for the most part, you know, he walks away, refuses to answer the question. He's not interested in metaphysical questions. He's interested in what kind of behavior can bring an end of dukkha, suffering, stress, dissatisfaction. And, you know, later Buddhism became very metaphysical and existential and all kinds of different paths, but the very early teachings were just what's called phenomenological. He looked at things from a first person's perspective and said, okay, forget about what the underlying reality is, what leads to peace and what leads to suffering. Okay. So in terms of the sense of self and not self, the question is, when's it skillful to identify with something as you, and when isn't? And sometimes it's very skillful, because, you know, you get here, and there's a sense of me, and maybe there's a sense of life isn't quite good enough, and there's this kind of sense of that you can make an effort and change, right? Now, you wouldn't have to call that a self. You could actually think of that as a bunch of processes going on. But, you know, if it helps to think of an identity, that's okay. And then other things aren't so skillful to identify with. So things that we don't have control of. For example, our body. You know, we can't stop the body from getting old. We can't stop the body from getting sick. We don't get to choose that we're, you know, 6'6" and a great athlete or whatever you want your body to be. You know, beautiful, some crazy ideal that the society's marketed to us. We don't get to choose those things. So, you know, Buddha's saying, what he said is, don't identify things that are inconstant and unreliable as self. And what are those things? Well, the body's one. Emotions, are they constant? Are they reliable? Can we ever arrange them to be the way we want all the time? Pleasant, unpleasant experiences, which I talked about last week. You know, you just can't line it up. So he says, don't claim that as self. So the thing about karma is that each time we perform an act, we create a disposition or an inclination to act that way in the future. We're forming habit patterns. And this is what we identify as what we are. And I've talked about the different kind of habit patterns we can form in terms of character types. So this inclination, once we do this over and over again, there's an inclination to behave that way the next time. It's a habitual way, but we just kind of move sort of semi-automatic pilot through life. Same responses. Now, this inclination influences this intention, this word I brought up earlier, our motivation. So intention is the Pali word is chetna, sometimes translated as volition or will. And intention's like the second path factor in the Eightfold Path. So in the Four Noble Truths, there's the first noble truth, there is dukkha, which is usually translated suffering, stress, dissatisfaction, which isn't the most refined, but tonight I don't have time to go into that. There's a cause for it, which is craving. And there's, you know, this very optimistic thing, the third noble truth is, there is cessation, that, you know, that it's possible to bring an end to suffering, stress and dissatisfaction. So those are the first three noble truths, and the fourth one is a path, a way to get there. And the first path factor is what is called, usually translated as right view. There's this word, Pali word, sama, that sometimes gets translated as right or complete view. Ajahn Tanisaro translated as, he basically says sama is related to a musical note. And he translates harmonious, which I prefer. It's, you know, right kind of has a, you know, very judgmental tone to it. This is the way to do it. But it's really kind of a harmonious way to be in life. So there's harmonious view, which is like an overall perspective when you come into practice of here's a skillful way to approach things. And part of that, and the view is very complicated, but just one part of it is that actions lead to results. That our actions influence who we are and whether we're happy or not. And intention is the second path factor. It's kind of the implementation of view. So intention has a strategic quality to it, like, okay, I mean, other parts about right view is our things are impermanent, unreliable. And so there's kind of a strategic view of certain things, if things are inconstant and unreliable, then how do we find happiness, lasting happiness? That's kind of a framework for the Buddhist teaching. And then the intention is sort of given that, how do you behave? The other aspect of intention is kind of an executive function. Some teachers use a like a general running the show. I guess I don't like military examples, but it's the thing that gathers together the energy so an action can take place. And these actions are actions of the body, the way we speak and think internally. And these actions have results. They have results that they form patterns of behavior, senses of identities, particular ones. This is really helpful, and I think some of the questions that came up last week about dealing with very stressful situations is that in the Buddhist view, each moment we have a little wiggle room to be different. We can pause and rather than act from our habitual way, incline ourselves to act some other way. And when I say wiggle room, it doesn't mean you can just all of a sudden decide that I'm not going to eat compulsively or I'm not going to get into this defensive mode or something, but you can start inclining yourself that way, maybe starting with little things, and you can gradually change. And so the Buddha noticed there's two kinds of thought. Thoughts that lead to a sense of uplift and peace, and thoughts that lead to suffering. And these thoughts lead to the way we act. And so basically, a lot of the teaching on ethics, the thing that Narayan and Stephanie Morgan are going to do, have to do with thoughts and actions that are uplifting. So a lot of practice, for most people, maybe their entire practice life, is doing things that create bright results. So what things are there? According to the Buddha, things that don't lead to uplifting results are actions based on greed, hatred, and delusion. And these are translations of some Pali words, the language that the Buddha was written down in, which greed, hatred, and delusion is kind of like the extremes of these things. By greed includes just subtle craving for things. It's kind of this insatiable desire to keep lining things up. So it's not just like, you know, greed, I have to be the richest person in the world or something. And the same thing in terms of the hatred. The hatred includes ill will, just a little bit of, you know, wishing like bad things for somebody, or even just aversion, just not wanting things to be this way. So maybe when you're sitting and your knee hurts, your back hurts, or you got some bodily pain and or even some unpleasant emotion, that the aversion itself is a cause for unpleasant karma, unpleasant results. Okay. And the opposite of those, actions of generosity, kindness, compassion, simplicity, are uplifting. Now, you don't have to take my word for this. This is something that the Buddha always said, ehi pasiko, come see for yourself, to explore that. So let me just give you a few examples. A long time ago, my first three-month retreat in Gaia House in England, I was on a personal retreat, so I could set my own schedule. And if you were last in line for breakfast or towards the end, there was a lot of stuff going by the time you got there. You know, the fruit might be there, things like that. And since I could set my schedule up any way I wanted, I find myself sort of hanging around the dining hall when just before breakfast, you know. And then it occurred to me, like, you know, you're making all this effort just so you can get some fruit or get the food you want. And how long does that last? Not very long. It's a trivial example, but we do this all the time. And there's a level of stress in it that we don't see. And this teaching on anicca, which is usually translated as impermanence, but really means inconstant, reliable, everybody knows everything's impermanent, right? I mean, everything goes at some point. Even this earth won't be here at some point. But when you really internalize it, you really start watching just how the mind and the body you just go through a day and just notice, like, when you're feeling really good and then something happens, you're not feeling so good, and then sort of okay, you know. And just notice how you get pushed and pulled around by actions and events. It's really a powerful practice. I mean, I've particularly been observing it the last couple of weeks. It's just crazy stuff, you know. And you almost, after a while, you start to laugh at it. It's not that it doesn't happen, but there's kind of a dispassion to it. It's really not a big deal. This compulsion to do, to have the mind engaged all the time, to be entertained, watch TV, got to read something, you just never just being content. Another example, I guess I've told this story a million times, but you know, it's not like the only experience I had, but it was very powerful. I was in sort of an uplifting example of kindness or compassion. Is I was at Whole Foods one day, and this little old lady was there. It's getting hard to talk about people being old now, but but her hands were shaking, and she had bad teeth and skin. And she came over to me, and she said, "Could you read this label on the milk carton for me?" Because she's trying to find some milk that wouldn't expire too soon. And, you know, I read it to her, and then I pointed out some other milk that would had a later date on it. And actually, even though her body was really not in good shape, she had a very sharp mind, and she thanked me. And this was really a trivial little thing to do. But it just felt so good. You know, it's just like when you let somebody out, you know, maybe he's trying to get out into traffic take the cart back in a grocery store so some poor person who's working for minimum wage doesn't have to do it. It's just these little things are uplifting. And so a lot of practice, it isn't so much about a morality. A lot of practice is about really observing how these things affect you. And the way to observe how they're affecting you is what Ajahn Suchito refers to as holistic awareness. Not just observing from a head place, but holistic awareness talks about knowing how thoughts work, knowing how the sense of heart, the felt sense of things feels. Is it uplifting for the heart? And knowing how the body feels. So in this karma example where you're kind of going through this action of making decision, you're doing the action and result, is to really pay attention to how, when you do things, you know, either, you know, skillful or unskillful things, how that feels to you. Okay, and really to take it in a bodily way. It is to enhance it, to really feel it. Because then there's more of an inclination to do that. So, you know, when you get in a rage or something, or you really scream at somebody, how does that feel afterwards? And how did that affect, you know, did you get what you wanted out of it? Maybe some people get on the, I don't know about you, but sometimes I find myself yelling at these automated answering things that just don't give you the option you want. You know, so it's pretty stupid, but I don't know if anybody else does that. And one thing that's skillful is, I mean, probably the most predominant cause of suffering or stress I've observed teaching is a sense of inadequacy. This self-judging characteristic. And is that uplifting? Does that make you feel better? I mean, it's kind of, we've been conditioned to do that. We get all these messages about how we should look, we should be productive, and all these things, and then we get messages from our partners, from work, we get weighed and measured, you know, and you're found woefully inadequate. It's all conditioning. It's a pattern we've been indoctrinated into. So starting to step back, this is what, it's not just that, it's learning to step back and see this and see what's skillful and what's not. And not, I see, it's not the word I particularly like, actually to feel how these various actions affect you. And one thing is that we all have flaws. But, you know, we can focus on the fact that we really do have good aspirations, and there are some qualities we have that are skillful, that we maybe care sometimes, we do have compassion sometimes, that we have some integrity. And even to look at, and not even, but also look at other people like that. Despite all their flaws, their aspiration is to be happy. And it's just a much better way to be in the world. You know, when I get angry with my wife, all of a sudden she doesn't have any good qualities. I have to kind of remind myself of that. Okay. So if we can just bring more empathy for ourselves and others, it's just a better way to be in the world. So this is actually, for a long time, what practice is for people. Developing these qualities of kindness, compassion, renunciation, which you maybe a nice word would be simplification, not needing so much. And meditation actually is supposed to be uplifting too. I know it doesn't always feel that way for people, but you know, it's a skill to develop. But it really is. The idea is to create a sense of a good sense of self, or a good set of programs, depending on how you want to language it. Okay. And these programs are both thought processes, the way the heart reacts, the way we treat our, actually the way we relate to our bodies. And a big part of that is to be grounded, to be in the body. So this is all well and good, but no matter how skillful you are at this, stuff happens, right? You just can't arrange it so you always have good emotions. You know, people wreck your car, or, you know, people say horrible things to you, or you get sick, or you lose your partner. You can probably put together your own list. And what happens is that, you know, maybe we're creating these bright results and are great, but the problem is that identifying with these patterns psychologically locates us. This is who I am. So when we're happy, we want to keep it. And then we're disappointed when it's gone. When we're feeling stuck and desperate in a bad mood, you know, we're miserable. And this is going to happen. Everybody has moods. Everybody has difficult experiences. You know, there's this sort of, I had this idea when I came to practice. D.T. Suzuki, who's a Buddhist scholar, said that they asked him what awakening was, and he said, it's just like normal, but being about 2 inches above the ground. And I thought, wow, that's what I want. That sounds really good. But, you know, it's not. That's not what we get. We get the ability to hold things more lightly. And let me just see it go down a path here. So the Buddha basically said, this is great, but, you know, stuff happens. So his solution is get out of the whole arena of cause and effect. Get out of the whole effort process of trying to line things up so they're okay. And, you know, he's basically saying if we can't control things, we can't control emotions, can't control how the body works, then don't identify with it as you. This gives you the ability to kind of step back out of the whole process and observe it. Sometimes this might be called mindfulness or awareness. This is a really simple and incredibly powerful aspect of this practice. That there's a part of the mind that can watch all the other stuff going on. You know, you can watch thoughts go, you can watch moods come and go. Or not you, the mind can do it. So that's a big part of practice, is learning to step back and just see how things are. And it was last night I taught Narayan's experience yoga class. For those who don't know about stuff happening, she broke her wrist and had surgery Monday, I guess, and apparently it's went well enough that she's going to teach metta practice this weekend. But, you know, stuff happens like that. So one part is just to step back and observe and not get so caught up in all the stuff that's going on, to know that these things just come and go. More radically, it steps out of the whole program. Let me step back a little bit, too, is when we develop all these programs, all these patterns of behavior, we're actually making a deliberate effort to develop particular patterns. That's not what we are. They're patterns. We've developed programs. And that's a helpful thing to see that, well, it isn't a self. It's a pattern that's learned, and we can learn skillful patterns. But the Buddha's being really radical and saying, step out of the whole program that your life gets fulfilled by having some particular state. About having a state that you're feeling happy all the time, fulfilled, everything is lined up, cushy, okay? Because if you want to get a particular state, it just perpetuates more karma, more action results. You keep trying to line things up. And it's kind of like being on a three-legged stool where one leg is shorter than the other two. And, you know, it's a constant kind of abrasion to it. So the Buddha isn't saying we shouldn't have... it's not that he doesn't want us to be happy. He's just saying that we're never content because... things you just can't lock them up. And what a gift to just, oh, it's like this right now. Okay. Now, you know, we talk about this not self, and last night in the Experience Yogi class, someone talked about how they were being overwhelmed by some really difficult physical experiences and sort of brought up this not-self thing. And you know, you can't just say, well, this isn't me. Because that's another program trying to say, well, it's not me, it doesn't matter. What you actually have to do is see these programs as stress-producing. That this effort to line everything up actually causes a level of stress. Because you're always trying to, you know, arrange things so they're going to be okay. I mean, just explore this for yourself. Okay. So, one aspect of awakening is a shift from a perspective of trying to line things up to sort of balancing these qualities of body, heart, and mind. And most of us are in the head too much. One of Ajahn Suchito's quotes I love a lot is, we're like a head on wheels, particularly in Cambridge, right? We're kind of running around, totally out of touch of our body, out of touch of our heart. And, you know, we start worrying about things, planning things, you know, and just fear, anger. The heart doesn't know the difference between reality, like what's going to happen if, and what actually is going to happen. It doesn't know the difference between those thoughts, the actuality and the thought. So the kind of worrying thoughts actually makes the heart feel uncomfortable. So it's a huge part of practice is learn to ground yourself more in the body so the mind doesn't spin. And to really just balance these three, to make an effort to do that rather than trying to line things up all the time. And to sort of just have this holistic awareness of what's going on. In terms of the heart thing, when we have difficult experiences, the idea is to just allow them to be. So I talked about this a little bit when I talked about this vedana, this sense of whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, is rather than reacting to these experiences, just allow them to do what they need to do. Which is, you know, they just arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. So actually, when we do this, when we really settle in, not trying to get somewhere, there's a sense of peace. There's a kind of quality of stillness. We don't need to get things. We don't need to get anywhere. That's enough. That's in some way actually described the awakening process. There's this quality of mind that isn't trying to line things up. And I'm dropping into that this moment. It has a lot to do with dropping down the body and just being. So it doesn't mean that this practice gets us to be free of difficult experiences. We're human, vulnerable, and yet there is this quality of awareness that can just hold it all, make space and room for it. And so sometimes you'll hear the teaching, well, how do you find comfort in discomfort? It's just to be aware of it. How do you find joy in the sense of non-joy? It's just this pure quality of awareness that just sees. There's a really wonderful quote by Master Sheng Yen, which I use a lot. He was one of Narayan's teachers. He comes from the Chan tradition. And his dying words were something like, busily doing nothing. And this guy's his last words, right? Busily doing nothing, growing old, in emptiness, weeping, laughing. Intrinsically, there is no I, no one to die. And what I like about this is here's a real master, and he's not saying, you know, all this stuff's gone. He's just saying that we know it's just conditions playing out. There's no one solid here. It's like we're like a rainbow. You know, light and moisture and a particular angle creates that. And what we perceive ourselves to be is very much like that. Conditions coming together. So it's all has a dreamlike quality to it. And I guess when I first came to practice, there was a Tibetan teacher giving a talk at the Unitarian Church in Harvard Square, and he said, well, it's all a dream. And so someone said, well, if it's all a dream, why does it matter? And he says, well, because you're in the dream. So in some sense, we do see it's all dreamlike, which kind of lightens it. And in the other sense, we're still in the dream, so we kind of have to negotiate it to live in a skillful way. But there's just a lighter quality to it. You can see all the stuff coming and going and not get so caught up in it. So I think I'll end there and just open it up to questions. And it doesn't have to be particularly related to this talk. Anything, you know, yes. Okay, yeah. Busily doing nothing, growing old, in emptiness, weeping, laughing, intrinsically there is no self, no one to die. So maybe I should say a little bit about this word emptiness, which is a really complex topic, so I'm trying to figure out how to get this down to something concise. Emptiness, at some level, one way to think about it is that everything is interdependent. We kind of have this sense of there's a me and there's the outside world, and there's some sense of a solid identity there, right? But if you really, and so I'm going to talk about this next time, I think, is if you actually, we never really see reality. Buddhism isn't about, awakening isn't about finding the ultimate truth.